I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Craig O'Hare. He is with the Office of Renewable Energy and Energy Efficiency at the Public Works Department of Santa Fe County. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So we are going to talk about energy and energy efficiency and also let people know about the Free Energy Forum for Homeowners, which is coming up this Thursday, the 3rd of May at 6 o'clock at the Santa Fe County Administration Building, which is on Grant Avenue right downtown. So energy efficiency, it seems to me that in this very lovely sunny place, we really should be able to make tremendous use of the sun and not use all that much energy. And yet, we talked about this just the other day on the show, when people build buildings, they're just doing it the same old way and putting in electricity and not putting in solar, even passive solar. What's going on?
Well, we have made some improvements, I think, in that area, but you're absolutely right. We have an incredible solar resource here in New Mexico and in Santa Fe County. We have 310 days of sun each year, and so we've got this great solar resource that we're still not doing enough with, although that seems to be changing as we speak fairly rapidly, and my job with the county is to try to make that happen even more and more. But you're right, we're still building and designing buildings that are not very energy efficient, and we're working in Santa Fe County on a new high performance building code or energy efficient code that's similar to the one that the city adopted, and luckily at the state level we have at least a better building code than we used to with respect to energy efficiency. But there's so much opportunity in the area of insulation and windows and high performance furnaces and air conditioners that we literally could build buildings that use half the amount of energy they currently use.
Let's start with, because I think it's probably more relevant to most of our listeners who aren't going to be building a house anytime soon, the whole idea of retrofitting your current house to be more energy efficient. Starting with the very easiest things to do, everybody's talking about weather stripping and things like that. What are the different steps that people can take in their own houses?
Sure, and that's a very good question. And essentially, there's two things to think about. And one is what we call the building envelope. And that is the building structure, the home structure itself, which is the walls, the ceiling, the attic if there is one, the roof, the windows, and things like that. And so the two things with energy efficiency you want to focus on are air leaks. Do you have leaks coming in through your windows that don't have good ceiling on them, or underneath the doors, or through the attic, or through the... A lot of people don't realize, but electrical outlets are a big source of air leaks to the outside. They don't really think about that. So the one thing, and that really comes into the category that you were mentioning of weatherization, and that is the fairly simple stuff, which is caulking, weather stripping, threshold, things like that to seal up those air leaks, because particularly on a windy day, you get a lot of cold air coming in the winter through those air leaks.
And a good do-it-yourselfer can go down to the home improvement store and get everything they need and do it themselves.
Exactly, and it's very easy. I'm not exactly, a Joe handyman, and it's fairly basic stuff that costs less than $20 in total, weather stripping and caulking, and it's easy to take a Bic lighter or a match or the back of your hand and literally, particularly in the winter, go around to your windows and your doors and things like that and feel whether there's cold air coming in. And those are the areas that you want to put the weather stripping or want to put the caulking or underneath your door if you've got, if you've got gaps that you can see through to the outside.
Right.
There's some really simple measures to take care of that.
What's the next step up from there?
Well, the next step up from there is looking at your insulation. And that's a fairly big step when we're talking about the building envelope. But some homes, literally, you can go and drill holes into the walls, if this is a frame construction, and have insulation blown into the walls or into the attic. A lot of homes that aren't, obviously, if you have a flat roof, you don't have an attic and you can't do this. But if you have a pitched roof with an attic, a lot of heat loss, because of course heat rises, ends up going up through the attic. And that's a real good place to both look for air leaks and look for opportunities to increase the insulation. And there are professionals now that are certified by an institution called the Building Performance Institute, and they will go in and do an analysis of your home and make recommendations on putting in insulation and doing air sealing and things like that.
the next step up from there, I guess, is putting in solar systems.
Well, the next step actually, from the standpoint of energy efficiency, is first we were talking about the building envelope, but then is what are all the appliances and the various things that are actually consuming electricity or natural gas or propane in the house. Of course, the big one that we think about initially is lighting and shifting. If you're still using those old super hot incandescent light bulbs, is the switch to the compact fluorescent light bulbs that use about a quarter as much. It's amazing how much you can drop your electricity use with that. If you have a very old refrigerator, it's an energy hog. New refrigerators use about half of the electricity of the old ones, and they're even bigger and have more features and things like that. And then you've got the furnace and things like that. And then you have what we call the plug loads. And the plug loads are the TV and the computer and the laptop and the stereo and all those sorts of things that when we actually push the off button, they're not really off.
Unless you have the kind that is.
Unless you have the kind that is, but most people don't. And so that's where the power strip comes in play, is that most of the time when you turn your appliance off, it's still on. It's still drawing 6 kilowatts, or not kilowatts, 6 watts, I should say. And a nice thing that's available at the Santa Fe Public Library is this little gizmo called a kilowatt meter. And that's a meter that you can plug in, and they'll check it out for 6 weeks to you at Santa Fe Public Library. And you can plug in your computer, you can plug in refrigerator, your TV, and actually see how much electricity it's using, and then get a feel for really, gee, I really should be turning this stuff off.
And even the power strips have little lights on them that themselves use energy.
Even the power strips. You know, and that all adds up. I mean, when it's going 24/7 over the course of a month, it really adds up. And so it's important. And those kilowatt meters are a lot of fun, and they come with instructions. And, again, I think it's the main library downtown and the Southside Library that has them, and they'll check them out for free. Lafarge doesn't have them. But that's a fun thing for people to look at and just see how much is their refrigerator using and things like that. So basically, we've covered the whole energy efficiency world. The building envelope and all the different appliances, the refrigerator, the washing machine, of course, is a big one, both for water and for hot water usage. And low-flow shower heads, those are all the things that we focus on when we talk about energy efficiency. And then energy conservation is behavioral things, which is turning off the lights when you leave the room, turning the furnace, you know, back down to 55 or whatever in the winter when you leave, and things like that. And then on the flip side is what you were getting to, Mary Charlotte, which is renewable energy, and which is solar power and solar systems on your roof.
We're talking to Craig O'Hare of the Office of Renewable Energy and Energy Efficiency in Santa Fe County. Now, staying with the question of all the things you talked about, the weatherization, everything like that, have you seen in this area that there is enough consciousness that people are doing these things and it actually is making a difference? Or is energy use just rising the way it tends to do? What's going on in real life?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I don't specifically have data on Santa Fe County to answer that question, but unfortunately, nationwide over the last 20 or 30 years, unless you're in California, which has had incredible energy efficiency programs, per capita or per person energy usage in buildings in the home has increased. And that's significantly due to a couple of factors. One is the size of the average American home has more than doubled in size between 1960 and 1995 or 2000. I mean, the average newly built American home in 1960 was actually 1,100 square feet. And by 1995, it was 2,300 square feet.
Oh, my goodness.
So, and of course, the average American family size decreased during that period. So all of a sudden, we became obsessed with having these really, you know, some people might even call that a McMansion, but a lot of people I know, your listeners, are in 2,400 square foot homes.
But well, you need those rooms for your new TVs.
Well, it's just, you know, bigger is better, and we got into this notion that we had to have these really large homes. And, of course, not only are there a lot of resources that go into building the home, but you have a lot of resources that go into heating and cooling a home like that when it's twice the size of the home, frankly, that size that I grew up in,
yeah,
with a family of five. But the other thing is also a really dramatic increase in the use of refrigerated air conditioning. And that's a big deal. In fact, even in Albuquerque and in southern New Mexico, where evaporative coolers, in my opinion, work really, really well, and that, you know, I think our low humidity is actually a really good natural resource we can take advantage of. People are switching to refrigerated air conditioning, and their electricity usage is going through the roof. And
they're switching from swamp coolers?
Exactly.
Why?
Yeah. Well, partly it's because to date, our electricity prices in New Mexico have been comparatively low. And a lot of people basically, you know, evaporative coolers are great. But when the monsoons roll in and the humidity does go up a little bit, frankly, they don't work as well. I used to live in Tucson, and there were, you know, days here and there during the summer monsoon season in July and August where my evaporative cooler didn't work that well. And so people have started to switch to refrigerated air conditioning. And that's okay when electricity is 9 or 10 cents a kilowatt hour. Of course, it's not okay from a lot of environmental standpoints. But, you know, electricity is not going to stay at that rate. And I think people are going to be disappointed with their utility bills and particularly their electric bill if they start using refrigerated air conditioning a lot more. In fact, we saw with the hot summer we had last year, we saw a lot of people going to room air conditioners. And, you know, that can be a significant contributor to electricity usage. And hopefully, you know, if climate change is really going to make Santa Fe's climate and Santa Fe's summers closer to Albuquerque's as far as heat goes, hopefully we can really focus on evaporative coolers as the means to do the cooling, because they really use 1/4 the amount of electricity that refrigerated air does.
They do use water. Do they make a significant impact on how much water we use?
Well, it's a good question, and it gets brought up a lot. But I would say, you know, the amount of water that an evaporative cooler uses is about the same as a 5-foot by 6-foot patch of grass. And we have to also realize that the coal-fired power plant that's giving us a lot of our electricity here in New Mexico up in the Four Corners area is consuming an enormous amount of water through their cooling towers. So when you look at the water balance between an evaporative cooler and all of the water usage associated with making electricity for refrigerated air conditioning, it's kind of a wash. And in my opinion, when we're talking about environmental issues and energy issues, you know, the slight water impact of an evaporative cooler is more than compensated by the fact that they use about 1/4 the amount of electricity that refrigerated air does. So it's really hard to say with respect to Santa Fe County. As you know, we've made great strides in the water conservation world, but I don't think we've yet made great strides in the energy efficiency world. And hopefully, and that's frankly the role of my job, is to promote energy efficiency and renewable energy in the residential sector and the commercial sector, both for environmental reasons, for economic development and job creation reasons, and also to help keep people's energy utility bills manageable over the long haul, because we're seeing rate increases by PNM and New Mexico Gas Company that are just going to keep on going.
So in addition to all of these things, we also have the possibility of putting photovoltaic systems on the house to generate electricity and or putting thermal systems to
heat water.
Now, first of all, can you get hot water when it's 0 degrees outside in the winter through the sun?
Yes, you can. Absolutely. And you can get it, you know, through solar thermal systems can work when it's 0 degrees out. Not as well. And luckily, we don't have, you know, here in Santa Fe, we don't have a lot of 0 degree temperatures. And when it is zero, the sun isn't out. Anyhow, it's before the sun has risen. But, you know, in our winters that have 20 and 30 degree high temperatures for a while, absolutely, you can get hot water. It may not be hot enough to take a shower in, but that's where you have you know, a combined system where you're still using a little bit of natural gas to boost it. So, you know, our tap water, as you know, when it comes out in the winter, is pretty darn cold. It can be, you know, 40, 45 degrees.
Yeah.
And so if the solar system can bring it up to 80 or 90 degrees, then we only need a little bit more energy to boost it to 120 or 130 that we might want coming out of our, you know, our water heater and into our showers and washing our dishes and our clothes and things like that. So absolutely. And the thing I'd like to, before I forget, when you mentioned solar photovoltaics, when that's the electric side of solar, is to emphasize to your listeners that solar PV, photovoltaics, is about half of as expensive as it was 5 years ago.
Is that right?
Half as expensive. So a system I'm having installed next month that is $7,500 for a small 1.5 kilowatt system that I'm having installed was literally $15,000 when I priced it about 4.5 years ago.
Oh, my goodness.
So that's something people really aren't
just
aware
competition?
Of. Well, competition, economies of scale, mass production, introduction of the Asian market in a big way. Of course, we've heard that in so many different aspects of our economy. But that has brought the manufacturing of the panels, and also the local installers have gotten really good at kind of making it much more production line kind of installations as opposed to custom type installations. And so they've been able to bring the price of the labor and the installation cost down. So that's one thing that's really important to realize for those who have looked at solar in the past is it's a lot less expensive now. And we still have a 30% federal income tax credit and a 10% state income tax credit. So someone could actually buy a 2-kilowatt system in the neighborhood of $10,000, which is a pretty good sized system, actually. You know, people, I think, still have this notion that it's going to cost me $25,000 or $30,000 to put a PV system on their roof. And literally for $10,000 to $15,000, you can get a pretty decent sized system these days. 40% of that, so $4,000 off of that $10,000 system, the feds and the state will give you back in an income tax refund. So your net cost gets down to $6,000, and then it's a matter of getting financing and spreading out the cost. And if you get decent financing, you can actually make your loan payment, your monthly loan payment, right in the neighborhood of the benefit you're going to get on your P&M bill. And so it starts being cash positive or at least cash neutral.
That's very interesting.
From the first month of ownership.
So your payment on the system is $50, but your P&M bill is $50 less.
Exactly. Exactly. And you have a power plant on your roof. And of course, once you've paid off that loan, let's say it's a 15-year loan or what have you, these systems have known to operate for 25, 30 years. They don't have any moving parts. The solar panels do slightly degrade each year. Their production, but it's only like 1.5% or so. So even after 25 or 30 years, we expect that these will still be viable systems producing electricity. And yet, of course, once you've already paid off your loan, the fuel is free. That's one of my favorite sayings about solar is the fuel, which of course is the sun, is free. And you basically have free power. And while PNM's rates may be 10 cents a kilowatt hour now, it wouldn't surprise me in 20 years for them to be 20 or 25 cents a kilowatt hour. So it acts actually as a price hedge. It's like a way to hedge your bets, if you will, against future electric rate increases.
So there is a renewable energy forum for energy and energy efficiency forum for homeowners this Thursday, the 3rd of May at 6 o'clock. It's on Grant Avenue in the county building there.
It's the county admin building. That's immediately east of the El Dorado Hotel.
Right. Yep, on Grant Avenue on the corner of Palace, pretty much, right?
That's correct, Palace.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's at 6 o'clock. And then there's also one next week for businesses.
That's right. We're doing one for commercial businesses, a renewable energy and energy efficiency forum for businesses. And that's at the same location, the county administration building, on Monday, May 7th at 6 p.m. And we'll be focusing both on solar power and renewable energy, but also for businesses. A lot of businesses aren't aware that PNM is required by law, by a state law, to have really aggressive energy efficiency programs. And so they will actually pay, in some instances, 50, 60, 70% of the cost of a business putting in lighting improvements, putting in refrigeration improvements like for walk-in refrigerators for mini marts and restaurants and things like that, and putting in new air conditioning systems. And so they will actually pay in the neighborhood of 50, 60, 70%, and giving these businesses paybacks that are sometimes less than 2 years. And there's all this funding out there to make that happen. And so we're going to have a representative from PNM's energy efficiency program to focus on all those great opportunities for Santa Fe area businesses.
Craig O'Hare is with the Office of Renewable Energy and Energy Efficiency at Santa Fe County Public Works Department. And we look forward to hearing more about this in the future and to seeing you on Thursday and then again next Monday. And if people want to find out more information, is there a website or a phone number?
There's website, there's phone number, my phone number, and anyone's welcome to call me, and I can give them the assistance in this area at 992-3044, or you can go on santafecounty.org which is our county's website, and then click on services, and you'll see renewable energy and energy efficiency. And I've got a lot of information about solar and renewable energy and good links and things like that. And my email address is on there as well. And be happy to hear from citizens or businesses all the time.
Great.
But, and I want to emphasize, some people get confused, but I work for Santa Fe County, but of course Santa Fe County includes the incorporated city limits of Espanola and Edgewood and Santa Fe. And so if you're a business or a homeowner and you're in the city limits, our services are available to you as well.
If you're in the city, you're also in the county.
You're also in the county. It's kind of a trick question.
Right.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Good. Well, thank you so much for being with us.
All right. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
I'd like now to welcome to the program Jeff Haas. He is a civil rights attorney. He's an author. He's a member of Occupy Santa Fe and Another Jewish Voice Santa Fe. Welcome back. Nice to have you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So you are working right now on a resolution that will be before Santa Fe City Council. Is that correct?
That's right.
And the idea is that Santa Fe City Council would say that the United States shouldn't attack Iran.
That's exactly right. And we think it's important to start at a local level and show that there is not support for a military strike on Iran by anybody. And that we have to begin locally because it's very difficult to get to the Congress and all of the people that might influence them. And I think it's an opportunity for Santa Fe to speak out around something both that would be a violation of international law, morality, could have catastrophic consequences on the Iranians, on the whole Middle East, the U.S. and Israel. I also think it gives us a chance to show ourselves as being on the right side of things and maybe start a movement. And the third thing is when we began to research this, we discovered that there's a website that calculates how much each town, each county, each state has spent on the Iraq and Afghanistan war.
Oh, my goodness. Tell us the number. I'm scared to hear.
When we put this together a month ago, tax money from Santa Fe had gone up to $186 million for just the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. Iran is larger than either one of those places. They have 60 million people. So you can imagine what just the cost is. And any hope of putting our resources into our school system, into our infrastructure, into our environment would be lost if we get involved in another catastrophic war.
So the idea is that different cities around the United States would speak out in this way?
That's right. Actually, the resolution that's before the City Council on May 9th, which has been supported by the mayor and three council members at least, says that if it's passed, it will go to the president and it will go to the congressional delegation from New Mexico. So we are on the record saying we do oppose a strike, a military strike on Iran. And yes, we would like this to be an example and to have it spread nationally so that our politicians know that in spite of the drum beating by the Republicans and by Netanyahu when he visited Congress, the people in this country do not feel it's in our interest, even in Israel's interest, to attack Iran.
Why does Israel want to attack Iran?
I think the reason they want to is, one, I think Netanyahu and Barak, their leaders, are motivated by political things. They want to make it look like they're the heroes and to play on patriotism and nationalism. But also Iraq, Israel is the only nuclear armed power in the Middle East. They have some 200 nuclear weapons. The most potential competition for them in the Middle East is Iran. And so they not only want to not let Iran have nuclear weapons, they don't want them to even be able to enrich uranium to have nuclear power or nuclear medicine. So I think it's an attempt by Israel to get rid of a potential competitor. It allows them to dictate the terms in the Middle East, both with the Palestinians and with their neighbors.
The thing that I'm most struck by, besides the economic impact, and we've talked, and I'm sure we'll talk again on this program about how if somebody had gotten together and say, how can we bring down the United States? I know. Let make them put all their money into war and none into their people. That victory has already been won by the so-called other side. But even more than that, there is just the human cost. Like, how is it that in this day and age, we are still thinking that you can solve problems by dropping massive amounts of firepower on people's heads?
You would think we may have learned something from Iraq. These are so-called disarmament wars, where we claim the other side is a threat. Well, we learned Iraq was not a threat. They had no weapons of mass destruction. The intelligence and head of the army in both Israel and the United States say Iran doesn't have a nuclear weapon and hasn't even made a decision to develop one. And the people who are most knowledgeable say that the most dangerous thing to do is, if you did drop a bomb on Iran, it would speed up. It would almost assure that they would have a nuclear program. So we need time to negotiate with Iran. We haven't talked to them in 35 years. We need to negotiate and recognize their legitimate desires and not just look at the Middle East as what the messianic leaders of Israel feel is threatening to them. The people in Israel don't believe in an attack on Iran.
They don't?
Well, they are against an Israeli attack on Iran. They seem to say they would accept if the U.S. attacked Iran. But, of course, we're going to pay the consequences for either one. Either way, it's the U.S. that supplied the weapons, the diplomatic cover, and Israel would do it, assuming the U.S. would come to their aid. And are we required to do that? If England came to us today and said they feel that Russia is a threat, they want to bomb them, would we be required, because England's an ally, to bomb Russia if we didn't believe that was true, if they weren't a threat? And so we have to decide a foreign policy based on what our interests are and what we see as legitimate threats. And we don't have to accept the extreme right-wing Israeli leadership's perception of what may or may not be a threat.
We're talking to Jeff Haas, civil rights attorney and author. And I'm wondering, I mean, so much of U.S. politics seems to revolve around the so-called Jewish vote and the Israel lobby and things like mm-hmm. that. And you were in a group called Another Jewish Voice of Santa Fe. There's chapters of Another Jewish Voice in many cities. Do you see a shift in American Jewish public opinion, or is it basically pro-Israel no matter what? Or
there's definitely a shift, and particularly among young people. And young people on college campuses are really appalled at the politics of Israel towards the Palestinians and how they treat them. And there's a division in the Jewish community. What AIPAC has is organization, and they have a lot of money. And I think that they
AIPAC
don't really
being the lobby.
And they had the lobby, the AIPAC lobby is what I'm talking about. They have a lot of money, and I think politicians have been way too afraid to recognize that they don't speak for most Jewish people. In fact, AIPAC in the last election came out strongly for McCain, and 74% of Jewish people voted for Obama. So they don't control what Jewish people think, but they have power and particularly money and influence way beyond who they actually represent.
To what extent are other city councils in other cities in the United States doing what Santa Fe is doing right now?
Well, Charlottesville, Virginia, where the University of Virginia is one that's passed one, and so has another town in California, and Oakland passed one in 2008. And there are a number pending in other cities. Code Pink actually has a model resolution that they're introducing in various cities. In 2008, the Council of Mayor passed a general resolution saying bring the troops home from Iraq, and get out of Afghanistan as soon as possible. And this was passed by many, many cities. It did not generally mention Iran, and that's why we have this resolution, because we feel the real threat these days is a possible war or conflagration with Iran that could blow up into the entire Middle East. And if you look at the map, there are 40 U.S. military bases surrounding Iran. They are not a threat to us. But the possibility of them responding and attacking one of our military bases in response is great. Or the Straits of Hormuz, I'm told, is extremely narrow. And if you have U.S. military boats and you have all kinds of Iranian boats, a war could start just because tensions get so high and then some incidents gets misinterpreted or used and claim as an excuse to go to war.
What if Iran were actually, really far advanced in developing nuclear weapons? Let's say that this was their number one program, that's what they were doing, and the United States deemed it not to be in their self-interest for that to happen. Okay, we are peaceful people, we don't think we should solve problems by dropping bombs on them. What is the right course of action?
I think the fact is that Iran is not.
I know, but let's say it was. Let's say that's the situation you have.
I think if you then I think you got to legitimately support a nuclear-free Middle East, and you say Israel shouldn't have nuclear weapons, Iran shouldn't have nuclear weapons. In fact, that's the position of Iran, and in fact, the U.S. should begin disarming. But it's to claim international law under the Non-Proliferation Treaty when Israel hasn't even signed it and has nuclear weapons, when Iran has signed it and is allowing inspections, and the U.S. has not lived up to its obligation, we don't look honest. We don't look legitimate to the rest of the world. So I think, yes, working for a nuclear-free Middle East is a legitimate goal that is in everyone's interest. And so I think that's what our objective should be.
We're talking to Jeff Haas. So you are working with another Jewish Voice of Santa Fe and with Occupy Santa Fe. The spring has come, the buds are out, and presumably the occupiers are reoccupying all sorts of cities. What's happening here in Santa Fe?
Well, I think people are coming out again. We've had a lot of support for this no attack on Iran. There's a very big demonstration and teach-in planned in August around Los Alamos and the nuclear facility there. We're beginning to get involved in, I think, stopping foreclosures here and a buy local in a food campaign. These are some of the things that we're working on. There's a beautiful, yesterday there was a beautiful turnout of people from Occupy in the park. There was music, there were tables, there were sign-ups around Los Alamos, around stopping the No Attack on Iran campaign. Food Not Bombs was serving food, there was music, and then there was a general assembly in the afternoon.
The Buy Local campaign, what are the specific goals of that?
I think it's to buy goods from local businesses as much as possible so that the money stays in the area. It doesn't go to large national corporations. And so it's an effort to, it's also energy-wise, it's a wise thing because people don't have to transport the food and the other goods from large distances away. And it is a move towards sustainability, which everybody feels is pretty critical in this era when we're using up so much energy to transport things all over the world.
There, I was thinking about the other day because I needed to get a few necessities for the household, and I thought my choices right now are Target or Amazon. Is one more local than the other? I mean,
if that's your choices there, that's pretty bad choices, obviously. And I think we have to support our local bookstore.
Well, bookstores are one thing, but you can't buy everything at a bookstore.
You can't buy everything at a bookstore. But as for Target, I guess you look for locally owned hardware stores or depending on what it is at Target you want to get. It's tempting, obviously, because you can get so many things there instead of shopping at different places. But I think by supporting local, you're taking money away from the multinational corporations and you're putting it in local hands, and I think that's good for the community.
And there is, with that issue, of course, always the reality that in so many cases, and I'm just going to leave bookstores aside because I just think everybody should support their local bookstores no matter what because they provide so much service, but for so many things, the local option is so much more expensive.
I think that's true, at least in terms of the cost that we actually pay. The fact that the goods that are produced by these other companies may be made by child labor or prison labor or people who are getting working under terrible conditions. Those are some of the hidden costs of those cheap goods.
So, Jeff Haas, going back to a little digression here, going back to the question of Iran and the city council resolution called No Attack on Iran. So what does it actually say, and why is it important for people to basically send this to Washington?
Well, partly it's educational. It gives all the reasons for why an attack on Iran would be bad. Certainly foremost among them is the analysis of U.S. military and intelligence and Israeli military and intelligence, all of whom have concluded that Iran does not have a nuclear weapon, has not even made a decision to have one, and many have concluded that the thing that would be most likely to cause them to go towards a nuclear weapon would be a bombing attack. So it would be totally counterproductive. It also could be calamitous in terms of what the consequences could be for the Iranian people, for Israel, for the United States, and for the entire Middle East. And we also feel like this is not, we've been through this. I've been fighting wars since the Vietnam War, the Central American Wars, the Iraq and Afghanistan Wars. I feel like I've been fighting most of my adult life or protesting against unjust, unnecessary wars that have both cost the United States in terms of its leadership recognition as a leader in the world, and it's had horrible consequences on the countries that where we've chosen to fight. I think another thing is, of course, we've seen, and I just heard the other night, they played Dr. King's speech at the Riverside Church, and the part of it they played was, we started a poverty program here, and I really believed in it, and then all the resources that were going into the poverty program got sucked into the Vietnam War, and our domestic needs never seemed to match up to what warmongers or what people think is necessary to do a war. And he just said it almost made the poverty program a joke because we didn't have the resources. They all went into a war. And he warned us, in the future, you cannot do that. You cannot take your resources and use them for the military-industrial complex to go into foreign wars when you have those needs. And here the needs are greater than ever. The discrepancies between the rich and poor are greater than ever. And so if we're decide to use those resources to start another war in the Middle East, then we're not going to have the resources necessary to deal with our needs at home.
So all of this will be heard and discussed at the City Council meeting on the 9th of May, which is in a week.
Right.
And so are you expecting people to basically show up and let their voices be heard?
We're asking people to show up. At 5 o'clock, it may get passed by unanimous consent, or it may not be. At 7 o'clock, we'll have an opportunity to be heard on that. And we're asking people to come between 5, to come to 5 o'clock, and then be ready to speak at 7. We need to speak, and, you know, we think we'll have a lot of people. We'll either be arguing why the resolution should pass, or hopefully thanking the City Council for taking a progressive stance and passing the resolution.
Jeff Haas is a civil rights attorney. He's an author. He's a member of Occupy Santa Fe and another Jewish voice of Santa Fe. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And I'd like now to welcome Terry Jones. He's president and CEO of Wolf Trap Foundation for the Performing Arts. And his new book is Road Trip, A Photographer's Journey to America's National Parks. He will be at Collected Works Bookstore tonight, Wednesday, the 2nd of May, at 6 in the evening. And he'll be giving a slideshow and presentation on this new book. Welcome.
Thanks. Good to be with you, Mary Charlotte.
So this is a book of photographs. It's not just of the national parks, but all sorts of people and places and things that you encountered on your trip. Was there any set of themes or subjects that you wanted to photograph, or did you just, like, go on the road and...
Well, you know, it had been one of those lifelong dreams. I had read, like many people, Steinbeck's Travels with Charlie when I was in college. And, like many people, you think, well, I'm going to do that someday. And life intervenes, and you do all the other things that you do in life and never got around to it. So, I mean, what I was trying to do was, and I did it solo. I drove entirely by myself. And it was really a chance to explore not only the country and not only the national parks that I dearly love, but also to kind of explore oneself, to kind of go inside myself and see what it's like to be alone, to see what it's like to make every decision. And so, you know, there was no art director there. Wasn't anybody saying, oh, gee, that's a great shot. You ought to get that one, or let's drive there today, or let's stay here tonight. You made all those decisions, and it really is kind of an eye-opening sensation to be alone for all of that time and to have the freedom to make those decisions. So I think it really was capturing the spirit of the road trip. I mean, I really think it's what it's about. And we very specifically say, yes, we're going to the national parks, but it's as much about the trip as it is about being in those parks.
That's the kind of trip that you do, or at least that I was doing when I was in my 20s. You know, you get in the car and you don't have too much stuff with you and you stop wherever you want to. And there is indeed a sense of freedom. How did your family feel about not being invited along?
Well, I guess the good thing is my children are grown now, so they're out doing those things themselves, and they have their own families. And you know, I did talk a long time with my wife about it, and we have a great time together when we travel together. But it is such a different experience. And this was given as a sabbatical. The board at the Wolf Trap Foundation had given me the sabbatical to have some time off and basically to do what I wanted, to explore what I wanted. And I think we both decided that was, you know, doing it alone gave you a very different perspective than you know, traveling with someone where you have dialogue. And, you know, you're very focused. It's when you're alone, you're just very focused on what you're doing, which as a photographer, that helps to be that focused and that sort of intensely aware of what's going on around you.
So did you stop a lot? Did you have long stretches? I mean, what would you see, for example, that would cause you to stop the car and start a photographic project?
Well, you know, one of my favorites is one of those old sort of road Indians. I was in Maine, of all places. It was at the beginning of the trip, and there was a photograph of this, you know, I don't know what he was, 20-foot tall Indian. It's the kind of thing you saw on the road a lot. Now, it was, you know, I was traveling in Maine. I was driving from Boston, you know, up to the parks in Massachusetts and in Maine, and obviously ending up at Acadia National Park. And so I actually drove by it. It's one of those things that, you know, you drove by it and you kind of did that double take and you look back at it and you're going, wow, I think I'm going to try to shoot that, because it was this huge figure just standing by the road. I have no idea. I assume at some point it was, to attract customers to a restaurant or something. It really didn't have any signage with it. So it was that kind of thing that you would see and just say, hey, that's interesting, let's stop. And, you know, sometimes those things turned into a good photograph, and sometimes they were just, you know, another snapshot, if you will. So that's what I look for. As far as how long, you know, I mean, I did travel. I drove a lot. I mean, I was there obviously getting sunrises. I was up for every sunrise, and I was catching golden hours at sunsets. And I actually tried not to drive much after dark, which is how I think I was able to sustain the pace, was to be able to, you know, drive, catch my last shots of the day as the sun was setting or in early twilight, and then literally I just drive and find a motel after that, you know, whatever was available.
Did you do any camping?
No, I didn't. You know, I took on the first leg of the trip, and I actually, I crisscrossed through Santa Fe, because obviously we have a home in Santa Fe, and so I did crisscross through there, and so I did get to see my wife and so forth at that time. But so on the first leg, I did take camping stuff. I was in a hybrid Tahoe, Chevy Tahoe, and so we'd kind of equipped it so that I could, thinking I might just get in between somewhere and not be able to find a place to stop. So I was equipped to do it, but I didn't. The answer is I did not camp. We enjoy camping when we're out on our own vacations, but I had so much equipment with me. I mean, I obviously had several cameras and computer equipment and, you know, did downloads every night. And so, you know, to have all of that and to camp wouldn't have made for, I think, a very good situation.
Yeah, right. Well, I was just wondering, because there's a number of photographs of wildlife and animals and stuff like mm-hmm. that. And I thought, oh, you know, where did you, I mean, that's the kind of thing where you basically, I think, have to stand pretty quietly for quite a while.
Right, yeah, you do, and I did. I mean, I found one of the things I would do, and one of the things you find, if you don't already know this, or people who are listening don't know this, is that the rangers at the national parks are just marvelous people, and they really love what they do, and they really know a lot about those parks. And so if you stop and ask them or talk to them and say, you know, gee, I'm really looking for, you know, where are the deer running? Where are the bison? You know, are they in this area? What area? And they'll tell you. And yeah, you can go and you'll find those. The other thing is the time of day. Obviously, if you get up early morning, you know, you're going to find a lot more of that. The mountain goat at Mount Rushmore, that was a very early morning. I was actually waiting for the sun to sort of fully get up and then do Mount Rushmore itself. I climbed to the top of George Washington's head. But so you find them at the right place at the right time, and I did have advice from National Park Service rangers who helped me do that.
Are there any photographers who are particular inspirations to you?
Well, I mean, the usual, you know, the Ansel Adams, you know, those kinds of people that you love to look at over and over again. I think those are the photographers that mean a lot to me. So, you know, whether it's a Thomas Moran or Ansel Adams or whoever, what I do is love to go back to a photograph. And so, you know, it can be a wide range. And for me, it's not just landscape. It's not just architecture. It's people. It's costume. Shoes. I mean, I love looking at shoes. I mean, one of the fascinating things I do when I'm out at fairs or places walking around, I'll actually, you know, shoot people, you know, boots, shoes, whatever they may have on. It's just fascinating to watch that. So going back to photographers who can capture that and also capture detail is I think, important to me. Just seeing, you know, seeing it from an angle that you don't normally get to see something is always fascinating.
We're talking to Terry Jones about his new book, Road Trip, A Photographer's Journey to America's National Parks. Do you feel like when you go to a place that you've been before and that you know well and that you have some history with, that you photograph differently there than some place that you're encountering for the first time?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I don't know. Not many people ask that question. I think the answer is yes, because obviously many of the parks in the West, the Utah parks in particular, I've been to many times, I've photographed many times, and I do think you look more intensely when you're back, you know, because you know what's there to be seen, and so it's again trying to find that perspective of something that you haven't seen or that's not the expected. And so trying to find that, I think that's what you do when you go. I mean, I did 88 of the, well, at that time there were 395 parks, now there's 397. But so I did 88 of them, many I went to for the first time, and there is sort of an adjustment. I mean, one of my favorite surprises was a small park, a historical park in Vermont called Marsh Billings Rockefeller National Historical Park. It was a rainy day. I had never been there, even though I'd been to Vermont a number of times and actually even run a theater in Vermont. But I had never been to this park, and so I didn't know what to expect. And it was raining. I'm going, oh, it's not going to be a great day. I'm, you know, probably going to breeze through this and so forth. I was so fascinated. This is an amazing park. And, of course, the rain actually just made for a perfect setting of it. And, it's all about... this is what I learned in this historical park, and that's the other thing on a trip like this. You learn a lot that you didn't know about this country. You know, when they settled Vermont, they basically took down all the trees. I mean, now you go to Vermont, there are lots of trees, and it goes to this beautiful forested area. Well, it was basically deforested when the farmers went in, took it all down. The marshes and the Billings, over a period of years, reforested Vermont. It was really their efforts. And so to understand that, and it's an active farm and forest and historical park now, and you just learn so much from being there. But I just captured these amazing images of trees and in the wet and so forth. And so I think that kind of thing is the great surprise when you go someplace and say, oh, guys, this isn't going to be a great day. And then you find something that just captures your imagination.
Now, you are the president and CEO of Wolf Trap Foundation for the Performing Arts. Tell us a little bit about Wolf Trap before we go, because that's also a national park, is that correct?
It is a national park, yeah. It is. It's America's only national park for the performing arts, and obviously that was part of the connection to me doing my sabbatical work in these other national parks. What it's best known for is a 7,000-seat amphitheater that does a wide range of performance from May through the middle of September, and we do everything from the National Symphony Orchestra to Jackson Brown and Train. I mean, you know, and jazz. I mean, Tony Bennett's on our board. He performs here. Bill Cosby. So you have the whole range of entertainment, and it was started by Catherine Feline Schauss, and she donated the farmland that created that park over 40 years ago now. And it's just a great space. We also have a vibrant education programs, particularly in early childhood education, and we have a very strong environmental program. So one of the fascinating things for me is back in 2000, I helped create the program called Face of America, which is a multimedia performance program where we commission new dance and new music, and we actually take it into the national parks, and we create site-specific work that we capture on high-definition video. We bring back that video and the live performers and do a multimedia event on stage at Wolf Trap, which then again is captured on high definition. And then the latest television iteration of this was on Great Performances of Dance in America a few years back. So there is a real tie to, through Wolf Trap for me, to the national parks, which made this this particular trip even more meaningful.
Terry Jones is president and CEO of Wolf Trap Foundation for the Performing Arts. The book is called Road Trip, A Photographer's Journey to America's National Parks. Thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
And once again, Terry Jones will be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore and showing slides tonight at 6 o'clock right here in Santa Fe.